Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Lester, who's a professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he specializes in economic development. His research focuses on the role of labor market institutions in fostering greater equity at the urban and metropolitan scales. And he's an expert on the impact of minimum wage and living wage policies on urban economic development. He is a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Lester.
Thank you.
And there's been quite a celebration in Seattle. Earlier this week, the Seattle City Council passed a minimum wage hike to $15 an hour. A lot of the credit goes to a socialist member of the council, Kashima Sawant. So what's your sense of how things are rippling outwards, if you will, from Seattle across the country?
Well, I think the passage of the minimum wage at $15 an hour is a nationally significant event, and reaching $15 sort of can't be underestimated or underappreciated. However, when you look at the actual details of the passage of the law, it really represents a compromise. It's not just a win from one particular side, but really is a sort of a well-balanced compromise in the law. So it will take a while to reach $15 an hour. And then afterwards, it'll be indexed to inflation. But they also had a certain number of adjustments to say small businesses or tipped employees maybe will take a little bit longer to get there. But ultimately, the goal was successfully achieved in getting all employers in the city of Seattle to pay a living wage or closer to a living wage.
Well, apparently, Kashima Sawant did push harder for a less forgiving phase-in period for this new minimum wage. But obviously the pro-business majority on the board, in fact, she was the lone vote on those amendments. But what's happening, though, in terms of, you know, around the country there have been lots of demonstrations. McDonald's workers are demanding and other fast food workers are demanding a living wage. It seems to me that this is starting to enter into just as that the Occupy movement created the sort of dynamic of the 99% versus the 1%. It seems to me that a similar move is taking place in the political zeitgeist here, where people, I don't know why $15 is the figure, but it seems to be, you know, entering into the whole political debate around the country.
And sure, and really that's what was sort of the background context to this passage. It really takes the kind of groundswell of organizing and efforts on the part of fast food workers and other low-wage workers and labor community organizations to really put the idea of $15 an hour or a living wage in general on the table in cities and states around the country. And if you look back a little bit further, I mean, I think what's interesting about both the minimum wage push, the fight for 15, and, you know, maybe even the Occupy movement, is that, you know, the issue of income inequality in this country has been an issue for the past three decades. It's been increasing. However, it really does take this kind of discourse-changing organizing to do anything. And what we see often is that the first moves will be at the city and regional level or city and state level before a bigger change at the federal level. So that's what's really interesting about watching these campaigns play out across the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Bill Lester, who is a professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he specializes in economic development. His research focuses on the role of labor markets institutions in fostering greater equity at the urban and metropolitan scales and is an expert on the impact of minimum wage and living wage policies on urban economic development. He is now a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. So the idea that the federal wage level now is minimum wage level now is $7.25 an hour. That's obviously more than doubled by what just happened in Seattle and what may be happening in other places. Now, the Congress has stalled a bill raising the minimum wage from $7.25 to $10.10. That's being stalled by Republicans. So obviously there's a gulf there between the federal and the states. At what point do you think will the states shame the feds into stepping up to the plate?
I mean, I think that's really the sort of the million-dollar question, and what we're seeing, not just on minimum wage, but on a host of sort of labor-related policies, is a real stalemate in Washington, D.C. So I think it's going to take more of these kinds of laws to really move things. But I really think that's sort of a very difficult question about when Congress will act. You know, it's going to take, I believe I'm not a political scientist, but it's really going to take that sort of groundswell of voters really rejecting this idea of not doing anything at the federal level. So we'll see, have to see how that plays out in the elections, not just this year, but in the future.
Well, in the state of California, Governor Brown has signed a law that will create a $10 minimum wage in California. And last week, the state senate in Sacramento passed a bill going further with a $13 wage floor. And in Chicago, a group of aldermen have signaled their support for the $15 minimum wage. Los Angeles is also looking into it. Providence, Rhode Island is looking into it, the $15 wage floor, particularly for hotel workers. What's your sense then of what do you think is driving this across these different states? And is there, it's, apart from the headline grabbing and the strikes by McDonald's workers, et cetera, is there any political coordination here, or this is just an ad hoc movement?
Well, I mean, I think there is some political organization kind of trying to coordinate these things. But really what you see when you see the proliferation of these kind of labor standards at the local scale, I really think it's driven by two phenomena. First is a practical one. It's because there is stalemate. It's so difficult to move things at a national level. Labor advocates will work where they can, which is often at the city or more localized level. The second part of that is that really it's the arena where the direct impact of income inequality is felt most acutely. So when you have cities like Los Angeles or Chicago, where there's been growth in the high-wage sector, some high-tech and finance jobs, alongside a proliferation of low-wage jobs, that imbalance is sort of most real at that local level. So it's not surprising that we're seeing a host of attempts to address this at the local level. These are often cities that have a rising cost of living. Rents are going up. It's more difficult to purchase a home. So the cost of supporting a family in a city like Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Seattle are growing faster than the national average. So it sort of makes sense that you would be seeing that push there.
So what is that then, Bill Lester, your sense of what the next step might be? Can you identify a kind of champion at the national level, given that things are stalled in Washington?
I think the next step would be, first as from the research point of view, is really looking carefully to see what is the economic impact of these sort of much higher minimum wage laws, like Seattle's $15. So we really need to study that and see what the effect is. If the effect, as research has shown in the past, is that it's relatively modest or insignificant impact on jobs, then I think you'll see the argument move out of these major cities to state levels, and I think some of the sort of paranoia about raising the minimum wage on the part of the right will be kind of fall on deaf ears. So that's one case. The second case, I think, I think President Obama is a champion for talking about and pushing for raising the federal minimum wage. I mean, I think his executive order to apply $10.10 an hour to federal contractors is a good start. Right now, he's very limited. So, I think it's going to take the next president, whoever that may be, to kind of keep the ball rolling. And hopefully, ultimately, there would need to be more support for this in Congress. And if you look at sort of the past times that there's been a federal increase in the minimum wage, it's most often done with sort of a divided president versus Congress. So there has to be bipartisan agreement. And that's something... whenever we've had a federal increase in the minimum wage, or really when we've had any major social policy, there's been some form of bipartisanship. So we'll need a return to a minimal level of bipartisan agreement to do something much larger around the minimum wage.
Well, Bill Lester, since this is what the research that you do is on the minimum wage and its impact on labor markets and both not just the minimum wage, also a living wage. What is the research then? What does the research tell us about the very arguments that the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, and Republicans are putting forth, and that is that this is a job killer? Of course, they have come up with this wonderful phrase called job creators that make it sound like anybody who's got a job in this country, their employer is doing them a favor. So that's the environment in which we are operating here in the United States. What is the reality?
Well, just to focus on the research that I and my co-authors have done, a series of papers led by Aaron Dubay at UMass Amherst and also with Michael Reich at UC Berkeley, we looked at the minimum wage policies across the country from 1990 to 2006, and we had this really neat cross-border research design. So we compared the minimum wage along state borders, counties that lie along state borders, and when one state raised the minimum wage, we use as controls the counties that lie along the state border that it touches, that it didn't raise the minimum wage. So in this case, we can really generalize these careful case studies that have been done in the past and look at every possible state or federal minimum wage change in that period and see, on average, what's the effect on wages and employment, and ultimately, in our second paper, on labor turnover. And so what we find is that when the minimum wage increases, we do see that workers get a raise. We see a wage effect, which shows that there is some kind of a treatment effect. But we look at employment. The employment levels basically are very small and statistically insignificant. So that kind of puts to rest a lot of these arguments on the opponent side, saying the minimum wage always kills jobs. So that's kind of, relatively definitive statement. And that paper's been well appreciated in both the public and also in the academic literature. If you want to look at going higher than these federal or state minimum wages that we've seen in the past, my other research has been focusing on living wage policies. Now, granted, living wage policies apply to a relatively smaller portion of the workforce. They're workers covered on city contracts or workers covered due to economic development incentives that a business would receive from a city. But there the research shows that the cities that try to pass these laws or successfully pass living wage laws don't see any kind of a negative effect in terms of job growth subsequently, the growth of new businesses, and even when you look at the sort of lower wage industries that are involved, you don't see sort of an economic negative from the living wage policies, which are much higher. The living wage policies are set closer to what the cost of living is in a major city.
Well, in this country, of course, it divided politically between the red and the blue states. And you're a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley, but you are at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, which is a very red state now with, I think, the reddest, if you will, state government in the country, a real conservative trifecta that they have there with both houses of state government and the governor. And they're rolling back all kinds of voting rights and environmental laws. And so from your point of view, what it must be an extraordinary contrast, because I often wonder about this country that's sort of heading in different directions. The blue states, particularly California, are moving rapidly into the 21st century and beyond, and many of these red states seem to be going back to the 19th century or the 18th century in terms of labor laws and about the 15th century in terms of their social attitudes to women's rights, gay rights, and abortions, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been some major political shifts in North Carolina, although I will say it hasn't always been as solidly red as it maybe seems now. It has been a sort of a purple state. It did vote for President Obama in 2008, and there are some demographic changes taking place in North Carolina that would seem to favor those on the left a bit. So we'll see what the future holds politically. But in terms of this sort of divergence, if you will, between sort of the blue states and the red state, I even think it drives even more local than that, almost down to the city level. I have another research project I'm beginning now comparing the restaurant industry and employment effects in San Francisco, which is sort of has the most regulations in the country. They require paid health care and paid sick leave and have the highest minimum wage in the country, to the Research Triangle area, which does not have any of those. So ultimately the question is kind of how will these labor standards shape employment conditions in this particular industry. But I think, you know, ultimately what will kind of settle this question is on the sort of growth side. Will the states that do not sort of move ahead and follow the lead of Seattle and San Francisco, will they fall so far behind in terms of having political gridlock, having, you know, just the high, you know, social costs associated with low-wage work? Will ultimately that drag down the overall economy? And there's many arguments for that. And I think we're starting to see, even in North Carolina, some of those sort of moderate and sort of business Republicans sort of oppose some of the cuts to say, you know, we can't have an economy if we're gutting education. We can't have, you know, a stable budget if everybody's applying for government assistance because they're paid such low wages. So it's sort of comes down to the question of what kind of region or regional or metropolitan economy you want to have. Do you want to have a high-wage, innovative, high-growth economy like Seattle and San Francisco? And there's a lot of other things involved there. Or do you want to have sort of a race to the bottom, low-wage, high-turnover type of economy? I think ultimately most people, when they look at that question, would want to side with the high-wage, sort of more virtuous cycle model. So we'll see what happens in North Carolina.
And, of course, this is not just North Carolina. Other red states in the South get much more federal money back from their tax dollars than, say, California, where we get much less back for the money we sent to Washington. So in a curious way, these blue states subsidize these red states. But I thank you for joining us, Bill Lester. I appreciate
it. Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Bill Lester, who's a professor in the Department of City and Regional Planning at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he specializes in economic development. His research focuses on the role of labor markets institutions in fostering greater equity at the urban and metropolitan scales, and is an expert on the impact of minimum wage and living wage policies on urban economic development. He's now a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley's Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.